Gallery Podcast.
Hello, I'm Miranda Hinckley and this is the National Gallery Podcast. Coming up, author and historian Jenny Uglow on Joseph Wright of Derby's passion for science. And
on her death in 1750, there was an entire volume of verses written by various poets throughout the Netherlands lauding her and praising her paintings, which I think was really unique.
Curator Betsy Wiesman joins the chorus of praise for the extraordinary and little-known Dutch artist Rachel Rauch. When the subject of our first interview visited the National Gallery as a boy, he had no idea he'd one day be responsible for the pictures hanging on its walls. He joined the gallery's staff in 1990 as Claude Curator of Renaissance Painting, and after a stint in Washington, returned in December of last year. Leah Caribbean went to meet Dr. Nicholas Penny, the new director of the National Gallery.
I was taken to the gallery by my parents. I remember my father, who was a barrister, and of course therefore worked in London. I used to come up to London and he took me to the gallery. I don't think he especially liked pictures, but like a lot of parents, you know, he liked the idea that his children might like them more than he did. I remember he also used to send me postcards. This is a bit embarrassing, actually, at my preparatory school, of the pictures that I particularly liked. But since they were almost always of nude figures, it caused merriment among the other boys. I remember especially, I was very, very attracted then by Botticelli's Mars and Venus. It is a rather fascinating picture. But I was absolutely...
What was it, though? What was it that grabbed you about it?
I don't know, but I used to draw it again and again and again. I liked the sort of the way that the mixing of the limbs, which actually is a slight weakness in the picture in a way, but it rhythmically it's a rather wonderful aspect of the painting. But anyway, I love that. But I remember the teachers at school were very worried by this fascination that I had with Botticelli's line. I think they probably thought something a bit kinky about that. But anyway, so he sent me postcards, and so I used to come to the National Gallery quite a lot. And I also remember when I was a teenager, I used to come, and I bought the National Gallery catalogues, which, if I remember rightly, cost 2 and 6, or less, in fact. These great scholarly catalogues. I was fascinated by the amount of information they contained, much of which has meant nothing to me. I mean, I didn't really even understand much of the discussion of provenance and all these learned footnotes. But I was fascinated that you could learn things about the pictures that you could tell your school friends and they'd be absolutely amazed.
And when you joined the staff in 1990, I mean, that's, nearly 18 years ago now. I mean, how was the gallery different then, do you think?
Well, the gallery was in a state of transition, to put it very mildly. I mean, you could actually feel, as well as see, some of the older and stiffer parts of the gallery falling away as it entered into a completely new life. And in particular, of course, the Sainsbury Wing was actually sprouting up next door. So it was a very exciting time.
And I suppose the Sainsbury Wing also started off a tradition of temporary exhibitions here at the National Gallery, which hadn't really quite been there in the same way before, had they?
This was a time when the exhibition programme in the National Gallery was expanding greatly. This was the first time that we'd had an exhibition space for larger loan exhibitions. The best types of exhibitions, as far as I'm concerned, for the National Gallery are ones where people which have some impact on the permanent collection. I mean, for example, the Bertone exhibition at the moment, it includes our own Bertones, but it also includes 18th century portraits of a kind that we have by all sorts of other artists, and it affects the way you see those elsewhere in the gallery, so that by putting on exhibitions in the National Gallery, the curators aren't just providing a sort of extra treat. They're actually changing the way that you think of the permanent collection here.
But what I'm finding really fascinating is that you're talking about the gallery as a home, and a home that you've had since a child, and I feel exactly the same way, and I think nearly everybody who visits the gallery regularly, even people who are maybe at a great distance, feel very particular about the National Gallery, that it does have this feeling of being a home, either a spiritual or a physical refuge, but a home. It does have that, I don't know, that personality, that particularity about it that perhaps other institutions don't share.
I think that's completely right, and that's why the National Gallery has often got into trouble in the past as well, because people don't like changes in their home. People like me, you know, who are curators and that, or even more, when they're directors of the National Gallery, have this responsibility. They're actually looking after something that belongs to everyone else. And, you know, this extends to almost everything. I mean, the feeling about the fig trees growing up the outside of the National Gallery, and they're not even in the National Gallery, but if you try to cut down the fig trees, I sometimes wonder also about, you know, whether people would be disturbed if there were fewer pigeons, which I personally would think would be a very good thing, but, and they cause a tremendous amount of nuisance. Even the pigeons are much beloved, so you have to be very, very careful in the National Gallery. If people are so worried about the pigeons and the figs outside, just imagine how strongly they feel about the Botticellis and the Titians.
In a few years' time, I mean, you've only relatively recently become director, but in a few years' time, what are you hoping that people will have in mind when they think of the National Gallery? I mean, I'm hoping it won't just be fig trees and pigeons, but what do you hope they'll be thinking of?
Well, I hope that they'll feel... This seems ridiculous, but it relates to what I've been saying. I hope that they'll feel that it's both a place where they can always go and see something new and a place where they can always go and refresh themselves at some source that they are familiar with, that they've known already. And that seems to me, if people can have those two feelings about the gallery, I also want people to feel that it's their own. And that's why I think it's also really important that they feel that it is something which is growing. I just feel that it means more to people if they know that it is actually changing, because not only new things are arriving there, but great new things are arriving there.
Leah Caribbean talking to our new director, Nick Penny. If you'd like to visit the exhibition he mentioned, there are just a few more weeks until Pompeo Bertone closes on the 18th of May. Tickets are available at the gallery or online with a booking fee at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. Cloning, GM crops, nuclear power. It seems as if science has never been so contentious. It's easy to blame this ambivalence on the pace of progress and imagine it's a modern phenomenon, but in fact it's nothing new, as a look at one of the gallery's most famous paintings, An Experiment on a Bird in the Air Pump, reveals. Author and historian Jenny Uglow told me more.
I'm standing in front of an 18th century painting, which is a moment frozen in time. There's a group of figures all gathered around the kitchen table, all the members of the family, and in the centre is a rather enigmatic-looking character with lots of white, long, bushy hair, who appears to be conducting some kind of experiment on a cockatoo that's trapped in a bell jar. Jenny, what's going on here? Who is this character in the middle?
The man in the middle is a travelling lecturer or demonstrator. He's demonstrating one of the exciting aspects of the demonstrator's art, which is the air pump. And he's got a very large glass vessel poised on a column. And in the glass vessel is the bird. And the bird is fluttering and near to death because from the pump down below, you see the handle, glistening handle next to those pistons. He's extracted all the air from the glass, but his hand is poised just above it to let us know that if he pulled the stopcock at any moment, he could flood the glass vessel with air again and the bird would revive.
So this was painted by Joseph Wright of Derby, who... There are a number of works by him dealing with sort of the advances of science and the Industrial Revolution.
Yes, Joseph Wright grew up in Derby, which was one of the main centres of the industrial Midlands. It had instrument makers, it had silk mills, and he was fascinated as a child by mechanics, and he went off then to be apprenticed as a painter. But many of his friends, when he came back to Derby, were experimental scientists or were industrialists. So they were making very important and exciting discoveries.
So Wright would have understood quite well what was happening in this painting, this process.
Yes, Wright would understand absolutely the process that he's showing. He'd have seen demonstrators do it, but also he asked his friends for help when he didn't understand things. So he's not just making evocative pictures. He's showing something that he really understands. It's quite technical. I mean, there are a lot of other things in the painting which are to do with pneumatics. It's a lecture on pneumatics, how the world changes if you do remove the air. They've got these Magdeburg spheres here, which you put them together, and if you suck the air out of them, they just cling to each other and you can't separate them. And this mysterious object in the jar, which people used to think was a skull, a sort of memento mori, reminder of death. And then people said, no, it's a sheep's bladder. And somebody very persuasively said, actually, it's human lungs. And again, that goes with the feeling that the painting is actually about air and the power of air, because Wright was an asthmatic. It was desperately important to him, the whole act of breathing, and one that was very painful and mysterious and precious.
This sort of a scene is quite alien to us today, in the sense that, you know, you don't have kind of wandering scientists who come and reveal the wonders of nature to you in your own home anymore. But I think there's something here about people's attitudes to science and kind of different feelings towards it.
Yes, of course there is. It's actually ever since this period that scientists have been thought of as rather dangerous, partly because the scientific endeavour, the rationalist endeavour, was associated with the philosophes in France who were behind the French Revolution, so that when the French Revolution came, they actually turned on the scientists and natural philosophers in their midst and said, oh, well, look what that comes to. And scientists were then, as it was, you know, set apart, mysterious experimenters. People always think that you're dabbling with the secrets of nature. It's very like the things that frighten us today, like cloning, you know, like creating alien forms of life. This is very dangerous. And yet, if you're going to cure something like Wright's own asthma, you've got to know about the mechanics of breathing and of air. And so it's a good thing. We want the advantages of science, but we're always a bit frightened that we're tapping into a power that could actually hurt us.
There's something really striking about this painting. It's not just the arrangement of the figures and the way he's sort of captured everyone's thoughts so perfectly in their faces. It's also the contrast of light and dark and the sort of light of knowledge kind of penetrating the surrounding darkness.
If you think of it as a demonstration, it's also like a bit of theatre, isn't it? It's like something glowing on a stage, and it pulls you in. It makes you think of earlier paintings, which are actually not scientific paintings but religious paintings, which have this glowing mystery at their heart. And in the National Gallery there's a little early painting where the Christ child in the manger is actually glowing almost exactly like this, and the faces are lit up watching him. So this is like a new miracle, you know, it's a new way of understanding the meaning of life.
Jenny Uglow talking about an experiment on a bird in the air pump by Joseph Wright of Derby. Rembrandt, Hals, Vermeer. If asked to name an artist from the Dutch Golden Age, few people would mention Rachel Rauch. Yet she's responsible for one of the gallery's best-loved and most beautiful still lives. Leah Caribbean asked curator Betsy Wiesman what makes the picture Flowers in a Vase and its little-known painter so special.
Rauch was a unique figure, in part because of her innate talent, but also because of her training and her background, which is quite interesting. Her father, Frederick Rauch, was a professor of anatomy and botany. He was a pharmacist, a surgeon. He was the head of the Amsterdam Botanical Garden. And in addition to that, he owned a personal collection of anatomical specimens and natural curiosities. And he called it the Museum Rauchianum, his own personal museum.
And how does that affect the picture here, do you think? I mean, I can see that we have standing on a ledge a glass vase in which we have a very beautiful collection of what look like fairly common or garden flowers. I mean, flowers that you might see anywhere. But nestling in amongst them are these insects. So what can we see here?
Well, there are two caterpillars that I can see. I particularly like the one right in the foreground that's just dangling from his thread and looking to land somewhere. It's this wonderful little suggestion of movement. There's a grasshopper on the table that looks about ready to spring to the other side. And then nestled up between the rose and the peony is a wonderful spider and an ant on the petals
tiny,
of the rose.
Tiny,
very tiny
ant. Oh, I can just see that. Now, the flowers that she's picked here, they do seem to be the sort of flowers that you might grow in a cottage garden. There's honeysuckle and columbine at the top, and roses, and there's a big bud of a peony on the right-hand side, and apple blossom, that's right, isn't it? And what are these orange flowers in the middle, do we think?
Those are lilies, and then just to the left of that, a marigold. And then I love the viburnum that comes up between them, and it's turned away from us so that the focus is on the underside of the leaf and those wonderful crinkles of the leaf. One of Rauch's most beautiful characteristics is her ability to render all these different textures and her use of light and shadow to bring the flowers towards us, to really create an illusion of three dimensions within the bouquet.
I'm right in thinking that this is quite an early piece of hers, isn't it?
It is. She was probably about 20, maybe 25 when it was painted, so just after she'd completed her training. What's fascinating about Rauch is that she goes on to become one of the most important and successful painters of the early 18th century. She was the court painter to Johann Wilhelm, the Elector Palatine, based in Dusseldorf. She didn't actually live in Dusseldorf, but she would send her paintings there, and she was also patronized by princes and rulers throughout Europe, so really a unique position in the early 18th century. And on her death in 1750, there was an entire volume of verses written by various poets throughout the Netherlands lauding her and praising her paintings, which I think was really unique. The other fascinating thing was that she had quite a family life as well. She was married in her 20s to another artist, not quite so successful as she herself, and between them they had 10 children.
Ten children. So there's all this extraordinary talent, and she manages 10 children as well, and she lives to a ripe old age. She doesn't sound like the picture that we have in our mind's eye, perhaps, of a downtrodden female artist. I mean, she seems to go against type, or is it a case that it was possible to have a career?
I think she was unique, and I often wonder whether it was because or in spite of the fact that she had 10 children that she became such a successful artist. Maybe her studio was her refuge.
Betsy Wiesman. You can see Rauch's Flowers in a Vase for yourself at the gallery, and if you're planning a visit during May, you might like to know that a range of flower-themed talks and events will take place throughout the month. Many are free, and you can find details at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back in June with news of the National Gallery's next big exhibition. Until then, goodbye.